On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Hello.
Hi, Marion. It's Evan Kleiman from Good Food at KCRW.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. With so much in the headlines lately about GMOs, we had to give you a call.
I'm glad to be here to talk about it.
Just a quick intro here. I'm on the phone with Marion Nessel, who's been writing about food, politics, health, and science for years. Her latest book, Soda Politics, looks at the powerful soft drink industry and the devastating impacts it's had on human health and food policy. Well, okay, now that we've got that out of the way, let's talk about GMOs. Marion, Congress amazingly green-lighted a GMO labeling bill this month. What's in the bill, and do you think the president will actually sign it?
Well, Congress had to deal with it. And the reason it had to deal with it was because Vermont passed a GMO labeling bill. And all of a sudden, the companies that sell foods with biotech ingredients in them were confronted with the problem of having to meet Vermont's law and having to have special labeling for Vermont, or they wouldn't be able to sell products in Vermont. So they went to Congress and said, "We don't like Vermont's law. Let's get something that's easier for us to deal with." And Congress did that. And it passed a GMO labeling bill that gives food companies three different options. They can put a statement on, like Vermont wanted, saying made with GMO ingredients or whatever the statement is. Or they can use a special symbol that the Department of Agriculture is going to have to figure out. Or they could put a QR code, one of those peculiar code things, and presumably you can take your cell phone and hold the phone up to the QR code and your phone will magically read whether it's got GMO ingredients or not. The people who were in favor of GMO labeling were very disappointed with this law because it really, first of all, you're required to have a cell phone, and secondly, to have a QR code reader on it, which I have to confess I don't have.
Neither do I. And it just seems that's the most obfuscating variation they could possibly have included.
Well, that's why the food industry wanted it. They really don't want people to know that these things are GMO because they're terrified that if people knew how many GMO ingredients there were in the food supply, they wouldn't buy the products. And they're really terrified about that. I just assume that all processed foods, without exception, unless they say organic, have GMO ingredients in them because they're completely prevalent in the food supply. What I don't know, and I really want labeled, are the fruits and vegetables that are in supermarkets that I don't have a clue whether they're genetically modified or not. I know which ones the Food and Drug Administration has approved. But just because they're approved doesn't mean they're being produced and sold in the market. And so there's a big gap in information there.
What percentage of our food contains GMOs?
Well, virtually all processed foods that contain corn, soybeans, cottonseed oil, or sugar are extremely likely to have genetically modified ingredients in them because practically 100%, very, very close to 100% of U.S. production of corn, soybeans, beet sugar, cottonseed oil, canola oil are genetically modified. And so if those are ingredients in those products, they will be genetically modified. The only way you can be sure that they're not is by buying organic. And it may be that what's going on with GM labeling is the best thing in the world that could happen to organics because people who care about these issues can really only be certain that it's not genetically modified if it's organic.
When the Senate was considering its version of the bill, protesters who were in the galleries actually threw $2,000 worth of cold hard cash onto the Senate floor. What was that stunt all about?
Oh, you know, I'd never heard of that. I was out of the country and I missed that completely. Tell me about that.
Well, just what I said. There were, when the Senate was discussing its version of the bill, apparently all of these protesters that were up in the gallery threw cash onto the Senate floor.
I'm assuming that that's a demonstration of how money talks in politics. I think $2,000 in cash probably isn't enough to buy Congress, but it doesn't take much. And certainly the GMO industry lobbyists have been hard at work telling Congress how difficult it was going to be for them to label their products as genetically modified, which to me is inherently ridiculous because Mars M&Ms have been labeled as genetically modified for months now. And, you know, the world hasn't come to an end, and I haven't seen any press reports that nobody is buying M&Ms as a result.
Do you think that lobbyists actually spend a ton of money to get the Senate to pass this bill?
Of course they do. There are websites that track the amount of lobbying that's spent, and you know that the genetically modified industry is spending a fortune because during the election, the GMO labeling elections in California and Washington and Oregon, they had to report the amount of money that they spent. And the grocery industry, the GMO industry, various product companies spent millions and millions of dollars fighting those laws.
If Obama does sign the bill, do you think there are winners and losers?
Well, Obama has said that he will sign the bill, or the White House has said that Obama will sign the bill, and I assume that he will. I haven't heard anything to the contrary, but it looks like he's going to do it very quietly. Yes, there are winners. The grocery industry, as far as I'm concerned, is a huge winner in this. They got to obfuscate the whole issue. So they've won. Some people think that the public is a winner because they got GMO labeling. I'm not sure. I would have liked to see something much more straightforward. The people who sell QR codes are going to do really well on this. And, of course, the big question is, what is the Department of Agriculture going to do? It has to write the regulations. Now, why is the whole question of GM labeling going to the Department of Agriculture and not to the FDA? That's an interesting political question. Probably because the Department of Agriculture's job is to support the food industry in every way possible. They'll probably write regulations that are very supportive. I mean, it's a complicated issue, and there are plenty of people who were for GMO labeling, as I was, who think this is just an enormous victory. I'm not so sure. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Do you know why Bernie Sanders was against the bill?
Yes. He was against the bill because it did not expressly state that a food was going to be GM labeled or not. It was obfuscated behind QR codes. And there are some very funny cartoons that are floating around that talk about QR codes.
I have to look for those.
Yeah, they're funny.
Well, it's a lot of exciting stuff. I can't wait to see what happens next. Thank you so much, Marian. And until next time.
I hope it'll be soon.
Bye.
Bye.
You can find other issues Marian writes about, from dietary guidelines to school lunches, on her blog, Food Politics. Next, we talk about a serious downside to taking antidepressants. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
There's so much pleasure in food, or there should be, and all of a sudden, you know, there wasn't, and I couldn't make sense of it because life was already hard enough, and now I wasn't even tasting my food properly, what little I was eating.
That's food writer Simran Sethi talking about losing her sense of taste when her father died, and she started taking antidepressants. Simran believes she can't be the only one to be faced with this issue, given that roughly two-thirds of the prescriptions issued in the U.S. are for antidepressants.
How did you discover that your prescription was affecting how you were tasting food?
You know, I actually wasn't the one to discover it. It was my mother. Two things happened simultaneously. My book was birthed and my father passed away. And I was ill-equipped to handle all these things that were happening at once. And I stopped eating. And it wasn't because I was deliberately trying to starve myself. It was just, it was the least of my concerns at that time. And in an attempt to get me to start eating again, my mother started making all of my favorite Indian foods. The eggplant bharta, the saag made with spinach, my favorite dals. I mean, she was in overdrive trying to get me out of bed and get me back to a healthy weight. You know, I would eat these things kind of half-heartedly and you know, without any sort of attention or excitement. But I'd make some comment to at least acknowledge, like, hey, my mom just made all these really, you know, great foods for me. And she turned to me one day and she said, I think your senses of taste and smell have been affected. You know, I didn't know what she was talking about. And she said, you keep talking about this one dish, the saag, which is made of spinach and greens. And she said, you keep saying it tastes metallic. This is the same saag you've been eating your whole life. And, you know, I've been eating it for, I don't know, some 39 years. I'm 45. And that was the first clue. And from there, I started researching to really try to understand if what she was saying, you know, had any merit. Because I was right in the middle of starting a book tour where I was going to be telling people, you know, week after week to feast on their lives, you know, to borrow Derek Wolcott's beautiful line from his poem, and to savor their foods. And through that, we would help preserve biodiversity. We would, through savoring, save our foods. So I needed to really investigate this for myself to make sure that I was going to be able to move around in my work in a way that felt authentic to me.
You refer to Prozac and other selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, as the Toyotas of antidepressants. What do you mean by that?
I go on to say they're widely used because they catch so many types of depression and anxiety in their net. You know, they're available in generic forms, but they're sold under brand names that range from Prozac to Zoloft to Celexa and Lexapro. They're wide-ranging. They're far-reaching. They're the first line of defense for many people who might walk into a general practitioner or a psychiatrist's office and say, I need help. They are so popular and so widely used, it was quite surprising to me that when I did my own sleuthing on the internet that I found only in the smallest of print at the end of the list of side effects that these drugs, these SSRIs, had the potential to impact taste, had the potential to distort it. They use the term perversion, you know, so distort senses of smell and taste or eliminate them altogether.
Ugh. Just I know, a horrifying thought.
Right? Exactly. It's horrifying. And no one talks about it. No one mentioned it to me as a possible side effect. You know, when you go, my father, ironically, was a psychiatrist. And so I know the protocol. You know, you walk in the door, he's going to ask you, have you lost weight? Are you sleeping? You know, what's your appetite like? But he's not going to ask you, like, what do things taste like? You know, through the research for this piece, what I learned was that depression reduces our sense of smell. There was a study that was done at the University of Dresden that showed that the olfactory bulb, which is the portion of the brain that helps turn these sensations that we experience into our sense of smell, is 15% smaller in people who are depressed, and that's regardless of whether or not they're on antidepressants. Other studies show that it diminishes the intensity of smell and taste, and I want to glom these together because that's kind of what we experience when we experience the flavor of a food. Those are the dominant senses that work together. So this is something that came as a real shock to me, that not only were we not talking about it, but even through the research, I learned that it's kind of underreported even within the community, you know, of medical practitioners. It's something that they know about, but they don't really talk about, not to each other or necessarily to their patients.
Is there any percentage put on the number of patients that experience this?
Not that I know of, Evan, because I don't think people are asked. There have been incredible discrete studies looking at what depression does to our senses of smell and taste. Then there's the question of what does the cure do to our senses of smell and taste? So then we look at SSRIs. For me, that metallic taste became prominent. Tricyclic drugs, in part, research says a saltiness. Benzodiazepines can enhance sweetness. There's all these things going on, but there's no one necessarily talking about it to patients or measuring it across a wide spectrum.
I just have to say that I have had my own experience with taking antidepressants, and my entire life, both my sense of self, my identity, and how I earn my living focuses on food. And until I read your article, I never even had a hint that this was a possibility. It's very disturbing.
Yeah. It's very disturbing because you so beautifully said, this is who I am. I write in the piece, food is how I navigate the world. How could I trust myself or know myself? And how could I be trusted by other people if here I am, a food writer? Part of my book talks about how we can taste food. So I take you through beer tastings, chocolate tasting, etc. And all of a sudden, I was like, how can someone trust me? And I would go through the tastings, and I wouldn't talk about what I was experiencing. I would ask people what they were finding. And no one would have noticed, you know, but for me, it was wildly disconcerting because, like you said, this isn't just what I do for a living. It's my identity. And it's the place where I derive a lot of joy. When I wrote that saying, Prozac is metallic and bitter, and to me it's a taste of betrayal, I meant it. I felt betrayed by the thing that was supposed to make me feel better.
And conversely, you say that a return to flavor is a return to self.
For me, it certainly was. And I think what I love is it has the potential to be that in a broader way. One of my favorite pieces of research, because it embedded within it was hope, is a 2006 paper that was written by researchers at the University of Bristol. And what they found was that what might be happening is these medications may actually be not only impacting our senses of smell and taste, but the actual taste buds themselves, the taste receptors within the taste papillae and the taste buds. So what that might be able to do is actually help psychiatrists and other practitioners better identify what's going on when someone is given an antidepressant. Because right now, there's an element of this that's kind of shooting darts at a wall. You know, my father, again, the psychiatrist, would say to me, like, this is wildly imprecise, and everyone's doing the best they can. But because the brain is just infinitely knowable and unknowable, you know, there's still a lot of guesswork involved in trying to find out exactly what combination of medicines or what, you know, single medicine was going to work for someone. And so this distortion might actually be a way to help researchers discover what is working. If our sense of sweetness is all of a sudden dominant, well, we know that this is actually affecting us and this might be useful for us. And if it doesn't have that impact, perhaps we should move on to another medication. So within that, I feel like there's something really special about our sense of taste that might help us navigate our healing as well.
That's food writer Simran Sethi. I talked to her earlier this year when her book Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love was published. Find a link to that conversation on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we turn the dial on our taste buds all the way up to 11. Don't go anywhere.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Ordering two sandwiches and a quarter white.
Yes, chef.
Ordering the wings and the waffles.
Yes, chef.
Thank you, chef.
That's the sound of the kitchen at Helen Ray's in Far East Plaza in Chinatown. Silver Lake's own Johnny Ray Zone opened the restaurant with his wife Amanda Chapman this spring. Jonathan Gold says it is the place to go for hot chicken in L.A.
There's a Nashville tradition started in a place called Prince's about 50 years ago of hot chicken. And the legend is that some relative of the current owner had a girlfriend who was tired of his messing around, so she made him a batch of fried chicken with enough cayenne pepper in it to essentially kill or stun.
But he liked it.
He liked it a lot.
A backfire to emotional hostagery, but benefit for us.
Whereas the chicken follows a lot of the principles of really good fried chicken, the extreme heat is the point of it. And if you get it at the level which they call howling hot, it becomes a decision that will take over your next 2 days.
So we're not allowed to have it, like, not quite howling hot?
Oh, sure you can. I mean, there's all kinds of levels, and I don't think I will ever order it howling hot again. But you should probably have at least one piece that way to see what they do. You know, medium is extremely hot. Mild is as hot as, say, other decent hot chicken places will have it. And then they have, they call it country style or something, but it has no heat in it at all. Anyway, we're here with the howling hot chicken. You get it, and it's straight out of the fryer when you get it. You burn your fingers when you're trying to tear it in half. The seasoning, which is this vivid scarlet, will work its way under your fingernails and all over your hands. You put it in your mouth. You try to get as much of the crunchy part as you can, and it's just a good piece of chicken, you know, that's salt and it's crunch and it's garlic. And there's sort of that musky, musty dried pepper taste. And it's not as bad as you think it is. 2 seconds later, it takes over. And it's like you've been punched in the face. It's like Oscar De La Hoya there has just punched you.
It's funny. The last time I was at the Far East Plaza, I was there to eat Chego.
Yeah.
And so I was just watching everybody else mop their faces with copious amounts of napkins.
Well, here's the thing. You've got this stuff under your fingernails, and so the sweat just erupts from your body, but especially from your face and your head. And so it's a hot day, and you're outside, and you unconsciously use the back of your hand to wipe the sweat off. And then you realize you've got a situation there, too, because it feels as if you've been lying on the beach for 3 hours without sunscreen.
I noticed when I was watching people eat this that the sandwich looked mighty good, too.
The sandwich is really good. You can get the sandwich that hot, too, if you like. It is, I don't know, it's a chicken sandwich. There's a bun, sort of like a soft bun. There's lettuce. There's something called comeback sauce, which is big in Mississippi, which is basically somewhere between Thousand Island dressing and remoulade. And there's a giant slab of chicken, like almost a whole breast. You can also get that howling hot if you like. It's delicious. You can get a pile of wings that you can put comeback sauce over and have your chicken that way. What makes this chicken hot isn't just the cayenne. He also uses extracts of habanero, some ghost pepper in there. There's some red savina, which used to be the hottest pepper in the world before the Trinidad Scorpion took over that prize.
This pepper thing is kind of insane. And I know this is completely gratuitous, but do they have anything for dessert?
They have chocolate chip cookies, but you're in this mall, so you may well want to, after your first 3 bites of chicken, turn tail and run directly into the scoops.
For ice cream.
For ice cream afterwards. What flavor would you like to taste? I don't care. What kind of ice cream would you like? Now. And there's also, of course, Endorphin Coffee, which is one of my favorite coffee stands in the city, which is right there.
And perfectly named.
Perfectly named. Where they make a pandan spiced iced latte that's absolutely perfect for super spicy food.
Oh, that's great. And you have plenty of time in that line to go get it.
You have time for seconds and thirds. I'd go to this place more often, but the last time I was in this line, it was 2.5 hours. And as much as I love this place, I'm not sure that I'm up to that every week. And it's sort of like waiting in one of those endless lines at Knott's Berry Farm and seeing people just stagger completely drained of blood off one of those roller coasters that have turned you upside down 412 times.
Jonathan Gold's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Howlin' Rays in Chinatown. Find a recipe for the country fried chicken they've got on the menu on the Good Food blog and text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. Now, how about something cooling, maybe pickled, to go with that fried chicken?
Laura Avery's got us covered at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, the heat wave is really taking a toll on us and our farmers and our customers, and we're here at the market to sort of share stories and reconnect with friends and farmers. I'm talking right now with Brandon Baudet. He is chef owner at Little Dom's in Los Feliz. Little Dom's has been in business quite a while, and they do quite a bit of pickling and preserving. Brandon, you're here on the pickle trail today. What are you going to be pickling? What will you be buying?
Right now in summertime, we got okra that's really great. And you actually just told me about some red okra. I'm going to have to try that out.
Check it out.
Sugar snap peas, and of course, the good old standby cucumbers for making pickles.
Now, the pickle cucumbers are those kind of little spiky, kind of peanut-shaped ones on them. They're kind of fat.
Correct. They're probably about 3 inches long, about an inch in diameter. When you cut them and slice them, they're about the size of a quarter. They're nice and crisp, and they lend themselves to making a great pickle.
The thing about those, they have kind of a thick, almost like a tough skin, whereas a lot of people now are kind of going over toward the Japanese and Persian cucumbers with a thin skin.
Right. Yeah, I do like to use that Persian style where the skin is thin. Even when you're making a salad, you can take those and just cut them right up and not even peel them.
Right, but for pickles, you want that thicker skinned one?
You do, yes. You want to soak them in salt and ice to keep them crisp. That way you don't get that sort of mushy, soggy pickle.
Right, right, right. So are you pickling these three things together in the same brine?
No, we do them differently, but the actual pickle recipe is pretty similar in standard.
Brandon, what is a basic pickle brine?
So first you start by slicing your cucumbers. You salt them because you want to release a little bit of the water, but you also add ice to them at the same time to keep them crisp, okay? From that point, you rinse off the salt, get rid of the ice, and then you create your pickling liquid, which usually consists of vinegar and then your spices. We use mustard seed, crushed red pepper, a little bit of turmeric. We also add a little bit of onion and red peppers to it. And then if we want it spicier, we'll kick it up a bit with some type of local pepper.
And you don't add any more salt at this point?
No, we don't. There's no salt added. It's just vinegar.
What kind of vinegar?
We usually use apple cider vinegar.
And are these to accompany the food you make at the restaurant or just to sell by the jar?
Yes, we do. We use them a lot in different ingredients. We use the pickled green tomato, which we put on our burger. We use the okra in our Bloody Marys.
Almost anything can be pickled. Fruit?
Yeah, we've pickled some fruit in the past. We've done like mostardas and things like that around Thanksgiving time. But yeah, you can pretty much pickle anything you want these days.
Right. And this gets done, this person that does it for you, that gets done sort of when the restaurant's closed?
Yes, our master pickler, as you would say, is Neil, and he comes in on off hours and kind of does all the pickling.
Sends you out here with a list of what he wants to pickle.
Exactly.
Right. And so I'm sure throughout the year, the seasons change, you pickle different things, but since you're pressure canning it, you have it available all year round.
We do. They can last for a crazy long amount of time before you have to use them, but we try to stock up on certain things.
Some people are talking, too, about just doing a quick pickle, like a little skillet, a little saucepan, a little sugar, a little onion, and then you just take that right out and you can use it right away.
Yeah, we do quick pickles for peppers. We actually do a different version, quick pickle with our green tomatoes. We do a quick pickle with actually cucumbers where it goes right into the refrigerator after it's, you know, the pickling process starts, and then we dump it into a bucket and goes into the refrigerator and stays refrigerated.
So are pickles a new thing for you, Brandon?
No, I actually grew up at my grandmother's house. My grandfather had a small garden, and you could always open up the refrigerator in the summertime, and she had a lightly pickled cucumber in the fridge pretty much all the time.
Just to cool you off?
Yes, it was great. No, it was great in the summertime. It was like always looking forward to opening up that refrigerator and seeing those pickles in there. The interest came up for pickling about 5 years ago at the restaurant. One of the employees was like, hey, I'm interested in doing some pickling. We actually took basically a home ec pickling class at my house, and we learned a little pressure cooking, pickling, of course, and canning jams and so on.
5 years ago, the whole health concept of pickled and fermented food was not as popular as it is now.
It's definitely like come around. Like we easily doubled in sales, the pickles that roll off the shelves.
All right. Thanks so much, Brandon.
You.
That was Brandon Baudet. He is the chef owner at Little Dom's. He has a full restaurant. He does pickles in the cocktails, pickles on the food, and pickles by the jar. You can get them either at the restaurant or online. I'm talking now with Luis Jaime, who is a farmer here at the Wednesday Santa Monica and many other markets in the L.A. and close-in areas. And Luis, you have this beautiful red okra. You've also got the green okra, which people are more familiar with. You grow at least two kinds of cucumbers. And then you have the dill, so you kind of have a pickle set up here at the market. Tell us about the okra. Let's start with the okra. How do you grow that, and is that popular?
Now it is. Before it wasn't. It took a while, but now people are more used to the red now. We sell with the restaurants. We've been selling it a lot.
Okra, a lot of people don't like it because if you don't cook it right, it kind of has that slimy stuff inside. Do you tell people how to avoid that?
There's not a slimy if you eat it raw. Like we're at the farm and we're hungry, we just eat, bite on them. When you cook it, I think with the steam or something, mm-hmm. it starts getting slimy. Mm-hmm. But the smaller they are, the less slimy that they are.
Okay. And now you have what I would call a typical pickling cucumber, and then you've got the Persian cucumbers as well. Do you sell the same amount of both?
More of the Persian, mm-hmm. I think people got more used to because the skin is so thin mm-hmm. and no seeds. And then the pickling, there's a lot of seeds.
Do you grow cucumbers pretty much all year round?
Try to. Persian, we usually do have it all year round. Mm-hmm. Pickling doesn't sell that much in winter. Mm-hmm. Persian, it does sell. So sometimes we keep it on the greenhouses, so we might have it all year round.
And then a big spice they use is dill, and you sell the dill that's just sort of gone to flower, or you call them dill crowns. How do you grow those?
We just let it sit for more, like a month after it's ready. It goes into seeds, and that's the one they use for pickling. So we bring usually a dozen or two dozen for chefs.
The dill seeds, not the green part.
Not the green part. The seed is not made yet. It's not formed. It's mm-hmm. just trying to get formed. Mm-hmm. So they use that to pickling.
As opposed to buying some commercial dill seed, which is going to be slightly different.
Correct. Yeah, this one is more flavorful. I mean, it's more stronger, the flavor, because the seed is still not there yet. You see the little jars with the little dill crowns inside.
The whole flower head, not just the seeds.
You can actually see it on the jar.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it is. Do you do a lot of growing on request? Do some chefs or customers ask you to grow things and then you grow that for them?
Now we do. We're starting to do that. We're growing the habaneros, the Hungarian carrot, and the lemon drop, which are like serrano. A yellow serrano and an orange serrano.
And are you bringing some to the market for the customers as well?
Yeah.
How many acres? I know you have three different growing locations. You've got one in Ontario, one in Yucca Valley, and then one in Lucerne. Are there different climates there that you can work with?
Way different. The one in Edison, in Chino, the season starts for the summer stuff. We usually start in February, March. Lucerne, we can't start anything until middle of April. But the season, we don't get a freeze in Chino until last year. We got it on the end of December. Mm-hmm. In Lucerne, in Yucca, that's on the clock. First week of November is there
freeze.
And freeze.
What a hard freeze, 20 degrees?
Oh, yeah. Whatever is summer, all the squash, eggplant, mm-hmm. okra, it's done.
We drove that route the other day. It's about, 200 miles round trip all the way. That's quite a bit of ground to cover.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we do it three times a week. Yesterday, Mondays, we pick in Lucerne, Tuesday all day long in Chino. Mm-hmm. And then we go, right now, one of the workers went to Lucerne to get all the squash, okra, whatever, the cucumbers. Mm-hmm. And then again on Friday. Mm-hmm. And then we do it on Saturday in order to avoid not to do anything on Sundays. So Saturdays is half day, you know, not because we harvest it on Friday, so you don't get a lot of production. But that way we don't... We relax on Sundays.
No work on Sundays. Good to have one day a week.
We still at the farm, but not as, we're not picking anything.
Yeah.
Just cleaning and, yeah.
And start again on Monday.
Again on Monday.
Oh, boy. Okay. So the okra will be around for the whole summer, for several months?
December. Last year, we had it until almost last week of December.
Okay. Well, it all depends on the weather, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Luis. Well, thank you so much. Of course, you've got lots and lots of other things here. You've got tons of greens. You've got some white corn, carrots, onions, kind of a whole smorgasbord.
Yes.
A little bit of everything. Okay, well, it's a beautiful stand. And you are certified organic.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get a recipe for Little Dom's spicy bread and butter pickles on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we get some tips for how to make some cash from writing about food. Stay with us.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Calvin Trillin's written about food for decades in The New Yorker. It may seem implausible, but he doesn't describe food in anything he writes. There's a consensus among magazine editors, Beard award-winning authors, and famed bloggers that a successful food writer is nothing more than a successful writer. Ruth Reichel says food writer is pejorative as much as woman writer is. She's a writer, period. Diane Jacob teaches food writing and has just published her third edition of Will Write for Food. Do you subscribe to that idea that a good food writer is a writer, period?
Yes. Otherwise, if you just write about food but you have no idea how to communicate, you're not going to be very successful.
I find that when I read engaging food articles, I seem to be more interested, the more refracted the actual food is in the article. If it's about memory or place or emotion, I'm there. If it's about yumminess, not so much.
Absolutely. That's because a lot of beginning food writers want to write an entire paragraph about how a brownie tastes. And, well, we already know most of the time. And it's just not interesting to read a bunch of adjectives.
Is that the primary mistake that newbies make?
It's one of them, yeah. Yeah. There's lots. You want to hear more?
Yeah, definitely. Give us more.
Well, I think what's hard for a lot of people who love food is that they just love food and they don't want to be limited and they love everything. And it just gets too vague and too big after a while and they get overwhelmed and they just stop.
What are some exercises you give your students? Do you ever make them write about things that have nothing to do with food?
No, since they're usually taking a class about food writing. But the thing is that food writing is about everything. So even if I ask them to write about, you know, the first sandwich they ever made, then it's going to be a story. I want a story. I don't want to know that it was just bologna and mustard. I don't care.
I mean, I guess until this conversation with you, I guess I really never understood how much we all already know. Like, we know what the white bread, the mustard, and the bologna taste like.
Yeah, we know it's squishy. We know the bologna is a mystery meat. I mean, there's no reason to tell people stuff they already know. You want to tell them, you know, give them some kind of a visual. You want to set a scene. You want to tell them where you were, that you were in a classroom and somebody sat on your lunch bag and you couldn't decide whether you're going to eat it and you were 5 years old.
How hard is it for people to find that unmistakable voice? Is that rare?
It's very hard. The problem is that the way that a lot of people get into food writing now is to write food blogs. And if they're the 3,000th person to start a baking blog and they want to write about banana bread and chocolate cake, well, what are they going to say that's different? How is anyone going to know that it's their voice? Now, if Ruth Reichel writes about banana bread, you're not going to confuse how she writes about it with the way that Anthony Bourdain might write about banana bread. You can identify each person's voice and their approach.
And what about a sense of place?
Yes, it's really important because it gives the food some context. And also because people, when they read something, they want to have lots of different sensual reactions to something. They want visuals. They want to feel like they're watching a movie. They want to taste it. They want to see who's in the room and how it was cooked or, you know, whether a horse went by, whatever it is.
Whether a horse went by. I had an incredible meal where a horse went by.
You did?
These days, with blogging and social media and food photography, it's such a different landscape out there. What are some ways that people who are interested can break into food writing?
Well, the easiest way is to start a blog, because there are no gatekeepers. You don't have to ask an editor if you can write a story for a newspaper or a magazine or a website. You just start. You just go to WordPress and set it up. It's very easy. Now, the thing is that no one will know it's there. So in the beginning, that's good because you may not know what you're doing, but eventually you're going to want people to read it.
Is teaching food writing a bigger business than it used to be because there are so many self-starter writers now?
Yes. It was really good for me because I have a journalism background, so I can explain to people what is a compelling lead, what are transitions, what is context, what is suspense, is there a story arc, how do you interview someone, how do you do research, all these things that were obvious to me as a journalist and writer and editor. But bloggers, most of the time, come to it with their love for food as a hobbyist.
Now, what about someone who's maybe been blogging for a year or two and now they're ready to actually get paid for their writing?
Yeah, I encourage that.
How hard is it? And what is your advice to freelancers that are looking for placement and someone who might edit them?
Well, bloggers, first of all, a lot of the time they start out writing things for other people for free because they're so, as I say, humbled and honored to be asked. And then after a while, that gets old and they start thinking, hey, you know, I'm putting in a lot of work here and obviously it's pretty good, so I should be getting paid for this stuff. And there are a lot of outlets and some pay next to nothing and most of them pay very little, I have to say. It's not really a great career move to become a food writer in terms of income. It's good to have an inheritance or to live with someone who has a steady job. Now, if you're a freelancer, then that's different, I think, because then you think of yourself more as a professional and you want to get paid decently for your work. And so there are some outlets for that on the web, newspapers, magazines, but it's still hard to break in and get the attention of an editor just because, you know, they get thousands of pitches on email and they have to go through them all. And 90% of them, probably more like 97% of those fail. I did recently have lunch with the editor of Fine Cooking and the food editor of AllRecipes.com, which are big national magazines, and they said they want to hear from bloggers. So I was kind of surprised. And you know why?
Why?
It's not the reason you think. First of all, some bloggers have become quite accomplished and they've become cookbook authors and they write good recipes and they know what they're doing. So they want to hear from those people first. But aside from that, they have a big social media following. So as magazines struggle with their circulation, they can attach themselves to bloggers who have a huge following, and the blogger can say, hey, I just got published in this magazine, and promote the magazine secondarily.
So what's your advice to freelancers who are looking for a different angle and learning how to hone original stories and then pointing them to the right market?
There is a way in through this kind of personal narrative that's based on storytelling. So if you know how to do that, you can be successful. Otherwise, there's still the traditional model of journalism where you profile a chef for a story, or you write what's called surface journalism, you know, the top 10 places to eat in Chengdu.
Listicles.
Listicles, exactly.
Everybody's a critic these days by contributing to sites like Yelp and also on blogs, but some only want to write good things. Do you subscribe to the negative review, whether it be for a restaurant or for a cookbook?
Well, I do. But the thing is, and I've written about that many times on my blog, because bloggers especially tend to gush. They tend to think, well, if I don't have anything nice to say, I shouldn't say anything at all, which makes a really boring review in my mind. I mean, it's not even a review. It's just more like a promotion. So really, the most interesting reviews are in the middle, in the gray area, where most of the time they're mostly positive, but they do have things to say about what could be improved or what didn't work. And as far as trashing goes, it's very rarely done. And when it is done, it has to be done with great skill. Like Pete Wells, you know, in the New York Times, his legendary trashing of Guy Fieri's restaurant in Times Square. You remember that one, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was all questions. Yeah, it was beautifully written. But that was a rare thing, and it was a thing of beauty. But he doesn't do that, you know, 90% of the time.
Talking about recipes and recipe writing, what makes a recipe compelling and, more importantly, maybe publishable?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? that everyone is trying to figure out. So, well, you can't write the same recipes that anyone can Google online and find 30 versions of or 100 versions of. So you have to come up with something different. So what is something different? Well, a lot of the time it's a twist on a classic recipe. There was a huge furor a couple of months ago because I think someone came up with a new way to make carbonara and people went berserk. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It was all over social media, right?
Yeah.
But that's an example of a really successful recipe because it made it easier and it worked. So those are two really hard things to do.
So how do you make a living out of writing about food, if I can be so personal?
Oh, sure. Well, like most food writers, I don't do it full time. I know very few food writers who write full time. It's really hard. You got to drive a beat up car and live in a marginal neighborhood. most of the time I teach, I coach people who want to write books or want to start a blog or improve their writing. And sometimes I write books with chefs that were a lot of fun. And so I do a lot of different things, which is also typical for food writers. A lot of food writers are also caterers and private chefs, or they do corporate writing, or they write in another field and they write, you know, about food writing in their copious spare time.
It's really good to put everything in perspective occasionally.
Yes. I like to tell people the truth about it because they should know what they're getting into.
It's true. Find out where to buy copies of Diane Jacobs' Will Write for Food on her website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. According to an old proverb, it's extremely lucky to have five daughters, especially if they're all born in a row. Helen Ahn, the matriarch behind the restaurant group, The House of Ahn, which includes Crustacean in Beverly Hills, hit the jackpot. With her daughter Jacqueline, Helen's latest venture is a cookbook. It's by sheer coincidence that their surname Ahn means to eat in Vietnamese, and it seems a most fitting title. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
It's a very beautiful book and a very beautiful restaurant. Helen, did you grow up cooking in your home as a child?
As a child, I never had to cook because I am youngest in the family. So my mother, she spoiled me. My mother, she say, you don't have to cook, but you can be a taster.
That's the best, to be a taster. And did she actually cook or did she have cooks that cooked for her?
She has a twin chef in the house, but she liked to cook too.
Why did she have three different chefs?
Because my father always entertained guests. So she has to be there to make sure what they cook for the party.
You grew up in a huge family. How many children were you?
17 children.
17 children, you're the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
So you had lots of mothers.
Yes, it's true.
She had a lot of teachers teaching her how to cook.
I bet. And these three different chefs who cooked in the house were Chinese, French, and Vietnamese, right?
Yes. One Chinese, one French, and one Vietnamese.
So interesting. So I think of the kind of food that you make, and the kind of food that you make is such a personal expression of this background. Were there any dishes that mixed things up when you were growing up, or was it all very separate?
No, it's a mixing up because I have influence of the Aunt Twisha. So I create my own cuisine.
When did that start for you? How old were you the first time you actually decided to make something a little different than was shown to you?
When I came here in 1975. My mother-in-law, she came here first. She bought very small deli Italian cafe. So we don't have any choice to survive, so we have to work.
When you first came here and your in-laws already had acquired this Italian deli, did they keep the Italian menu?
Yes, she kept exactly the same. But she adds some dish, like a crispy roll she called minty vitamin roll.
love this multivitamin roll.
Because they have a lot of ingredients. For her, it's a lot of vitamin.
I love that.
That's and Vietnamese food is always about a lot of herbs, like my mother was saying, and the balance of that and eating healthy. So when she was creating that menu, there's a lot of proverbs about eating well and how it keeps you slim. So she was ahead of her time in terms of the marketing.
Was the deli in North Beach? What part of town?
Yes, in 46th Avenue and Judah in San Francisco.
In the Sunset District.
How long after the restaurant transitioned did some of your girls, your own daughters, start working there?
I have my daughter. They come back from the school, and then they come to a restaurant. I ask them to do sample the work, like crispy roll.
Cutting onions.
Cut onion.
That's my earliest memory. After school, around 6 or 7, I would come help my mother in the kitchen cutting the onions. And for me, that was so much fun because that's what the adults do. So being able to help and peel the carrots.
So you were happy to do it. It wasn't like you said to your friend, oh, it's such a drag. I have to go home. I have to go help in the restaurant.
Oh, no. It was so much fun. And our restaurant was like our second home. And I remember being small and entertaining the guests. Even though I was 6 or 7, I would, you know, say hi to the guests. And if whatever I learned from school that day, I would, you know, sing a song to them. And everyone was, it was a neighborhood restaurant. That's how we started off as.
Jacqueline, we've been talking about Vietnamese cooking, and your mother's talked about how she makes this creative mixture of her influences. But in terms of just the Vietnamese cooking, how does it differ from other Asian cuisines and other Southeast Asian cuisines?
Yeah, sure. So the key thing of Vietnamese food is all about balance. We kind of strive for that balance between salty and sweet to create that elusive umami flavor. And you see that in a lot of our dishes, the caramelizing, the use of fish sauce. Fish sauce itself, it creates that depth of flavor that everyone talks about now.
There's always that indefinable overlay of French cuisine that sort of keeps it from becoming too extreme, in my mind. Do you think that's true?
I do. And my mother's cooking is a perfect example of that. As simple as a wok dish, we use the base, instead of cornstarch, which sometimes is used for thickener and stir fry, my mother used an onion roux to create that extra dimension in the dish.
I love it. As you're talking, your mouth is starting to water.
That often happens when I think about my mother's cooking.
So why did you decide to move from this lovely sort of casual family restaurant to something much more grand? And did that first happen in San Francisco, or was Crustacean in Los Angeles the first elaborate, fancy, one might say?
It started in San Francisco. So we had Tang Long, which is still here. We opened in 1971, and it's still there today and as popular as ever. And then we opened Crustacean San Francisco, I believe, in 97. And that was our first high-end version of, you know, Vietnamese cuisine.
What kind of environment were you trying to create? Why was it important to go that step and do such a more higher-end presentation?
We were thinking about the stories that my mother used to tell us about her life in Indochine, Vietnam, the entertaining that my grandfather did. And when we were creating that restaurant, especially with Beverly Hills, we thought of that kind of creating the second home, like, and how it was for us or for my mother back in Vietnam.
But a more formalized presentation.
Yes.
Do all the sisters work in the restaurants? Is it totally a family affair?
Yes. All the sisters are in charge of managing the different restaurants.
Is your role as a recipe tester? What was your role in bringing this book to the public?
I always enjoyed cooking with my mother and grandmother and hearing the stories. And I enjoy writing. So this project was just perfect for me. One of my key motivation was that I wanted to make sure that my children knew about the amazing culinary legacy that my mother has created for them and for these recipes not to get lost. So I called my mother up and said, Mom, we have to put this in a book.
So what do you think of this whole conversation of women and food being part of a family in which that's your reality?
There's a saying that is, if you want to keep your husband, you have to know how to cook. And so that's part of the culture. In Vietnam, you entertain and you do business over a table. So it's not only for the husband where it's a source of pride to have a wife who can cook, but for the wife themselves as well, that they're able to cook so well that everyone's envious and everyone comes to their table.
Are most of the chefs in the restaurants men?
In our restaurant? No, there's a good mix.
And how do they find their way to you?
Definitely through culinary school. Some of our chefs have been in our family for so long. Distant relatives or relatives of ours who's been trained with my mother for the past, I guess, 30 years now, 30, 40 years now. We have one chef that started with us from the beginning, so she's been there based almost over 35 years.
Mm-hmm. What's her name?
Van, Chef Van.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting because it just seems that women who work in, who are not owners, often their names aren't even mentioned. The women that are working in the kitchens. You hear about the guys,
mm-hmm.
but
it's true.
You don't hear the women's names. Now, I understand that you have a secret kitchen at Crustacean. So if you are so concerned about keeping certain things private that you built a separate secret kitchen, what was it like deciding to open up and put all of these dishes down in a public book?
I don't think it's hard. If they think it's okay, we don't need to keep the secret. So then because I want to pass to them some my souvenir, because based on my life, so I told my daughters, I don't have money, I don't have a goal, but I have some question to pass to you. So I just want to keep some for them in the case something happened to them. At least they can survive. And if they work hard, they can make money and depend on them.
I'm curious about the secret kitchen, though. Does it still exist?
Yes.
Yes.
On my restaurant has a secret kitchen. They have big kitchen and they have a secret kitchen and open kitchen.
Jacqueline, being part of such a sort of open source society with the internet, do you find it strange?
A little strange, but I also understand my mother. These are her recipes that really have brought us to where we're at now. And like I was mentioning in the book, for so long, recipes were never written down. So I understand that perspective. But I was also very surprised how open she was when writing this book. Basically, almost everything is in this cookbook.
Oh, that's good to know. What foods are made in the secret kitchen?
Just the garlic noodles and the crabs. So we couldn't create a cookbook with just two dishes.
That's so interesting. The garlic noodles, did they start out being like the simple Italian oil, garlic, and chili spice?
The major ingredient is the garlic. Looks simple, but it takes time to do it.
Well, everything is like that. I really believe that sometimes the simpler the dish, the harder it is to learn because the things that make it unique are so subtle.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Helen Ahn and her daughter Jacqueline's new book is Ahn to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, and Pete Bloomberg. Who am I? I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.